Hello.
Hey.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project.
Frankly, I wish there was a candidate that I saw that would be fantastic, because I love what I'm doing. In fact, I have a great club that's 15 minutes away. By the way, Ron Paul cannot get elected. I'm sorry.
Oh!
I think he's a good guy, but honestly, he has just zero chance of getting elected.
Oh! Bravo!
If I run and if I win, this country will be respected again.
Bravo!
A Young Person's Guide to Politics. Appendix A. Ron Paul, The Final Fantasy. Critical thinking question, how are we going to get all of the corruption and predation and abuse out of our government? Hey, come to think of it, how are we going to get all the gambling out of these casinos? How are we going to get all those scissors out of the barbershops? How are we going to get all those squirrels out of our trees? And how are we going to get our nuts away from the squirrels? And so on.
There's a place in the world for the angry young man, with his working class ties and his radical plans. He refuses to bend, he refuses to crawl, and he's always at home with his back to the wall. And he's proud of the scars and the battles he's lost, and he still has a place as he hangs on his cross. And he likes to be known as the angry young man.
So, first of all, we should introduce ourselves. I'm Brett.
And I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Mandrick.
And we are actually in the Free Talk Live studio in Keene. Stephanie, We just recorded Free Talk Live, the Sunday show with Mark. And now we're doing what was almost going to be an extended edition of Free Talk Live, but we decided to repurpose it for...
For what?
For my show.
Oh, is this for your show?
Yeah.
Wheels Off of Liberty, gotcha.
No.
So,
let's... On the show tonight, we were talking about this Occupy Wall Street movement. And, you know, I see a lot of people getting energized, realizing that something is wrong, and also, you know, smaller percentages of them wanting to do something about it. All of these people, they have this energy, but they don't know exactly where to put it. And I think, like, they might be putting it in a place where that energy and that enthusiasm could be better spent somewhere else. So we, some of us anyway, have experience with this through the whole Ron Paul thing.
Bravo!
I think we all do.
In 2008. And we're seeing a lot of people have that kind of enthusiasm and hope, for lack of a better political catchphrase, again in this 2012 election. So, yeah, I wanted to, as new, younger people come to these ideas and, you know, become adults, and it's so much easier today than it was 10, 20 years ago to realize how much there is that's wrong, and maybe to want to get active about trying to do something about it. I'm trying to dissuade people from Ron Paul in the one direction, maybe the whole Occupy movement in the other direction, now that it seems like its goals are pretty misguided.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I mean, I know you have personal experience with this, and so do I, but should we kind of give some background on that for the listeners?
Sure. As far as the Ron Paul?
Yeah, as far as our own experiences with it.
Yeah. So what was yours?
Well, so I started listening to Free Talk Live in about 2005. And before that, I was familiar with the Free State Project, and I had been reading LouRockwell.com. So I had a pretty solid foundation in kind of the anarcho-capitalist type of libertarianism. You
sure.
know what I mean? Before that, I had questioned religion, so I was an atheist, and I think that the two for me stem from very similar philosophical roots, really, belief in one's own competence and kind of free will and self-control and that kind of thing, and being responsible for one's own actions. But Let's see. I found out about Free Talk Live and I started listening to them, and that was kind of how I found out about Ron Paul and heard some coverage of him at the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I considered myself an anarchist, actually, but I was really messed up about a lot of things. I think I was really scared about a lot of things. I had grown up in an environment where I was taught to fear everything, basically. And while I had the philosophical interest in liberty, I think maybe partially because of my authoritarian background and the way that I'd grown up, I hadn't worked out some of the personal issues that were kind of causing me to feel all this fear. And one of the things that I really feared was getting active in any sense, but especially getting active outside of politics, which I thought was the safe route. I thought politics was the only safe thing that one could do if one wanted to create some kind of change.
Sure, and a lot of people will tell you it's the only way you're ever really going to do anything. You know, like,
yes,
if you really want to make a difference, you have to work within the system.
Yeah. So there were so many of those unmet needs and fears there. You know, I was afraid of getting cracked down on, and I now know that politics is not safe. You know, you can still be targeted as a political activist for sure.
Sure.
And I was definitely feeling my need for acceptance being threatened. Like, I thought people would think of me as a crazy anarchist or crazy libertarian if I didn't try to play the political game and try to at least seem like I was fitting in with social mores, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so at the beginning, when I moved to New Hampshire in 2006, at the beginning of when I came here, and up to 2008 when Ron Paul was starting to come on the scene, I did politics.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I voted, and I kept up with all the political stuff, and it was so damaging. It was just like I felt like I had to keep up with all of these things and get to know all these characters, all these politicians, and all this trivia about them, and I was getting sucked into it, and I was listening to all kinds of political stuff and kind of letting it...
It's fairly depressing, too.
Yes, it's depressing, and it really consumes you, and... It's so beyond your control. Like, there's so nothing you can do about it. Really, like, nothing you do in politics is going to make much of a difference. And I'm sure that's something we'll talk about
sure.
in this discussion. But yet, you get so emotionally invested in it. And it becomes this, like, emotional roller coaster. Like, you're just hoping and hoping and hoping my candidate will win and then things will change. And then, of course, it never does. And so it just ends up hurting you, your soul. And, you know, in 2008, I was kind of starting to change my mind about this and starting to realize that politics was not serving my own needs and goals for what I wanted for liberty in my lifetime. And I wrote actually a book about Ron Paul. I interviewed him and I worked with a bunch of other authors on this book. It's a biography. It's called Ron Paul, Life of Ideas. And, you know, I got to talk to him, and it was at that time, I think, that I really let go of the political process, because I realized by talking to him that he has these ideas, some of which I really disagreed with, like his religious fundamentalism and his,
sure.
the fact that he became an OBGYN doctor basically to keep women from getting abortions and to make sure that didn't happen.
He had a pretty heartfelt story about that, though, I think, based on his own experience where he saw an illegal abortion happening. I think, and the baby was still alive when it was born or something, and they just... Left it sit there. I have heard him relay that story before.
I have heard that story too, and I never asked him about this myself, mm-hmm. so I'm not sure if that story is true or if it even comes from him. But I heard something to that extent, yeah, that he saw an abortion and was just really disgusted by it and switched from being a medicine resident to an OBGYN. But
I remember him telling that story. I remember hearing him tell that story somewhere.
Okay.
I don't know. It's
been a while since I've thought about this stuff, so.
It just came to me when you said that. That's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and sure, I could understand that, but at the same time, like, it seemed a lot of it was so religiously motivated. And
oh, absolutely.
He was, like, he was the only OBGYN for 60 miles radius in Texas, and I'm sure that there were women who maybe needed to access safe abortions because they had really horrible things happen to them, incest, rape, regardless of what you think of that, a lot of people... make exceptions for those kind of things, and I don't know if he was very amenable to that. So
yeah, but if he had, I don't think he should have to give a woman perform an abortion if he personally feels he's against it.
No, he shouldn't. But most doctors will at least
recommend somebody, yeah.
refer them to someone else. And I don't even think there was anyone around that he could refer to, even if he was willing to. But
that's true.
I mean, anyway, it was at the time when I was working on this book that I really, I think I completely got sidetracked here. Maybe, Brett, you could edit this down to make it sound like it makes sense.
Or maybe I won't. If it sounds fine to me, sounds good.
But it was around this time that I was working on this book, and I heard some of his ideas that I really realized that it was the ideas that were important, and it wasn't the political process or the political activism. And so the 2008 election happened, and he lost, you know, and he lost dismally in the primary with like 8 or 9% in New Hampshire. And there were a lot of people who got really excited and really emotionally invested.
Oh, yeah.
And they were thinking that he was going to really kick ass in the New Hampshire primary. And if he couldn't do it in New Hampshire, then there was no hope, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and he couldn't do it in New Hampshire, at least in 2008. So at that point, I really took a step back and I started looking at this whole political system and really questioning whether it was doing me good, you know, whether it was good for me mentally, emotionally, all that kind of thing. And I came to the conclusion that no, it wasn't. And I stopped following politics. I stopped following political news and I felt a lot better. And then I started listening to, at the time, Stefan Molyneux, and I started listening to Wes Bertrand, his podcast, Complete Liberty, and I started just thinking about it a lot more critically and came to the conclusion that for so many reasons that politics is not effective and, in fact, can be counterproductive. I think I will take that stance.
And stressful and soul-crushing. And, you know, I think there was so much enthusiasm and emotion that was poured into that Ron Paul campaign that a lot of people walked away from it just feeling not just that politics was pointless, but they kind of conflated the whole idea of the pursuit of a freer world.
Oh, absolutely.
Was pointless. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to not just talk about pointlessness. And I would, you know, I would even say that there's some real ethical problems with trying to make the government into what you want. You know, other people be damned. But this whole Ron Paul thing also, in many ways, might be counterproductive, both in the short term and in the long term. And before we get into that, Medrick, you said you had a similar experience.
Well, I definitely remember the feeling of after, you know, everybody realized Ron Paul had lost. But at least for me, from early on, very early age, I'd even say middle school, I pretty much rejected what I was being taught at public school. And, I mean, by high school, I was refusing to stand for the pledge, and I remember having to have a conversation with my principal about that, in which I had to sit in the office every morning during morning announcements, because they would do the pledge after morning announcements, and then I'd walk back to class at the end of announcements because of this. So I'd always rejected government, and just doing something because I'm told that's what we're supposed to do. I'd always question everything, but I never had... I hate to make the Matrix comparison, but it's that thing where you know something's wrong, but you don't really have a solution. You don't know what the solution is. And I see a lot of that with the Occupy Wall Street, the Occupy movement. So I'd rather than try to search, I mean, I had the internet. It was still early. I graduated from high school in 98. And I mean, the internet was still fairly young then. So I don't know. I didn't really know where to go for it. And I didn't really look. I just kind of rejected government. But I didn't have any solutions. And as I got older, I found myself just voting for like Green Party or Libertarian, not really understanding what they represented, but just because it was different from the norm.
You know? I can relate to that too.
Yeah. So it really, I kind of went through life like that through most of my 20s. And I just kind of, I don't know. I mean, I just didn't latch on to anything. I didn't really look into it. I just distracted myself with video games and other stupid crap that was just basically time waster. And then when I found out about Ron Paul in 07, I latched on to that. I mean, it really hit me. Like, I heard his message, and I was like, wow, this is awesome. This is exactly what I've been looking for. And, you know, I rode that wave, that whole thing with, you know, all the money bombs and all the on the forums and doing sine waves and going to rallies and stuff, meetups. And I did all that, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I met some great people. And then you were saying, you know, right after... In 08, when everybody realized, okay, he's not gonna win the primary, it was just this devastating feeling, just like, wow, Was, yeah. What a huge waste of time that was.
You know, there were people in denial about it because at time I was on a bunch of political email lists and all
Ron
kinds
Paul
of
forums.
Ron Paul, I don't think I did the forums, but a bunch of lists like Yahoo groups and stuff.
Yeah.
And there were people in New Hampshire who were in denial about the fact that he lost.
And recounts
they were like, let's do a
stuff.
Recount.
Yep.
And they were pushing for that. And it was just like, let it, you know, move on. It happened that way.
I remember, and I think it's probably still there. If you go to the Ron Paul forums, they have a, they'll tell you like most members ever online at one time was whatever that day was in early 2008 mm-hmm. during the, I guess, was it New Hampshire? Is New Hampshire the first?
New Hampshire primary.
That night, there was like 5,000 people on the forums.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was like the, and I remember because I was on the forums and we're all watching it. And,
yeah.
But I just remember how it was. So for me, that year following, I just kind of just really didn't care anymore about politics. It was so, just hearing it was just like anathema. Just, ugh. Just, I didn't want to even hear about it after going through the whole thing with Ron Paul. And then the following year, in 2009, I started listening to Free Talk Live. Like, I still consider myself a Ron Paul Republican. And then when the summer of 2009, when I started listening to Free Talk Live, and I stumbled upon it on the Ron Paul forums by a Free Stater. And a week after listening, I was a voluntarist. And within a month, I had an agorist business. I mean, and I didn't really consider the whole Ron Paul thing until I moved up here a couple months ago.
And well, just so we can clarify before you go any further,
yeah.
Voluntarist, you mean, you know, the philosophy that all human interaction should
sure.
be voluntary, and you can, since you are, you know, you've had some success with agorism, can you just explain what that is in a nutshell?
It's just basically selling products, running a business without permission.
Right.
And I let my reputation, you know, my reputation's there for the public to see. They know, I think I have a pretty solid reputation for cooking and people know who I am, and, mm-hmm. you know, I built that up over the years. So, I mean, listening to the Free Talk Live made a big difference, and also School Sucks.
Thank you.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that mm-hmm. really, I think if what Free Talk Live did for me, I guess you could say politically, School Sucks did for me personally, just because just hearing about it and hearing stories and reflecting on my own life about how my time in public school. But once I moved up here, I realized, like looking back, I really analyzed my time spent with the Ron Paul campaign, that whole movement. I realized if I would have heard Free Talk Live instead of before I saw those Ron Paul videos on YouTube, I would have instantly latched onto the idea of liberty as a voluntarist and not as a Ron Paul Republican. So I almost feel like I wasted, there's a little regret there. Like I wasted my time with that when my mind was more than ready to hear the real ideas of liberty, not the political ideas, not so much through the political system.
And I think that's, you know, one of the goals for this show is that I'm hoping that if there are people who somehow hear this but are also looking at these two main movements that are counter to mainstream politics right now, trying to save them some of that frustration and what eventually might turn out to be heartache. And,
yep.
you know, I mean, I spent money on that campaign.
Oh, yeah.
I bought little flyers to hand out to people. And
tons of time, I'm sure, you know, money and time.
No doubt. It was a valuable learning experience to see how controlled the media was, what things were acceptable to talk about and what things weren't, how people would be treated in the mainstream by those who intend to do nothing but preserve the status quo, how somebody with, you know, these types of ideas that cut into the ideologies of both parties,
mm-hmm.
when somebody comes along and they're, and for that reason, Ron Paul is a great educator, and you know, he might not be the best spokesperson. I think he's a little hysterical. He has a tendency to cut himself off. I'm sure he's a nice man, and he's certainly smart, and he's a good
author.
He is
very nice.
He feels like a real person.
He's definitely a real person. Yeah. But I think that when somebody comes along with a consistent message, and they have principles that they apply consistently, it really has that way. I think I said before, these glass houses that these two political camps are in, it gets turned into mirrors, you know, and they see their own aggression and they see their own violence. And the more I think about it, the more I'm confused, honestly. And I'd like to get some input on this. You know, for a long time, I, along with Stefan Molyneux and plenty of other people, and Stephanie, I'm sure you covered this and you know, your work as well. If people, I tried to show that just the disparity between personal ethics and political ethics, you know, and if you took somebody's political ethics and you made them live by those in their personal life, they would be like a rapist, cat burglar, murderer.
Well, but actually, Steph had a show about this once, too, that they actually are. I mean, like, if you look at the credit ratings of a lot of the Congress members in the U.S., mm-hmm. they're dismal. Wow. If you look at the number of times that they've, had all these affairs and all this, I'm kind of blanking out right now, but like they just,
the people that are like so anti-homosexuality and then they're caught with a man
and then they're actually gay. Yeah.
But I mean, even the people who support them, you know, like, my mother's friend, who's a wonderful lady, but will vote for whoever the Republican nominee is.
They just pull that, vote for all of them at the same time or whatever, hit that button.
But yeah. So the distance between, you know, this is what's right for me in my personal life, and this is the kind of behavior I'll accept from my leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you took the kind of behavior you'd accept from your leaders, and you said, okay, now I'm going to go and live my own life like that. It's like me saying, I said, I think in the first podcast I ever did, I'm going to take, I want to be a successful entrepreneur in private education. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the public school's business model, which is a gun, and I'm going to go point it at people and get them to sign up to give me, a few $1,000s every year.
I believe you said you would go door-to-door.
Door-to-door with a gun and a yellow legal pad.
Yeah.
To make it official. And I don't have to point the gun
well,
at them.
Well, the clipboard would make it official.
Yeah, the clipboard.
There you go.
Mechanical pencils. And I don't have to point the gun at them. I can just, like, you know, be waving it around, twirling it on my finger while I make my pitch, and I think they'll get the message. But those are the public political behaviors, ethics that are acceptable to just about everybody. And what I've started to realize is maybe people don't want to see that. Maybe politics is like this arena, you know, this cage match place, this game of cowboys and Indians for adults, where they find a sophisticated way of fantasizing about aggression against people they don't like. Because as the Tea Party movement grew, and you would listen to people like the MSNBC pundits or somebody like Bill Maher, the vitriol and the hatred and the violent ideation that they would have towards these people was absolutely unbelievable. And now, the right-wing talk media is like this all the time, but the way they're talking about these Wall Street protesters, it's just like, you know, fantasizing, almost talking on their shows, like fantasizing about the police using violence against these people. You know, I mean, people who have, in many cases, nothing. A lot of these people are desperate. Some of them might just be spoiled college kids who don't understand economics. And I think a lot of the people there probably could use a little, you know, a lesson or two in economics. But, I've never want to see, you know, just for someone disagreeing with me to want to see violence carried out against them.
Haven't you ever seen people watch those videos of, like, Iraqis getting mowed down by gunship, you know, U.S. gunships, and they're just like, I used to work with people that would watch these videos
they
and
act
be
as
like,
if
yeah!
it's a video game.
Oh, it's and it's like, you know, that's a person. He could have kids. You know, it's just like, nope, they just completely detach that. It's like, haha, we're winning.
But could they do that if they just were watching, like, you know, innocent children who didn't look like them, but in another country like India? Or like we saw the outpouring of support and charity that came for people who don't look anything like most of the people in this country in Indonesia and Sumatra in 2004 when that tsunami struck.
Yeah.
Is it because they can just attach this little thing like that's protecting America, that's fighting terrorists, those are the bad guys, then as long as they have that little justification, then they can fantasize about all the aggression they want. And they can cheer for all the aggression that they want. So is politics actually this outlet for something else? You know? Mm. I mean, I'm a guy who in my life in the past, I've gotten mad and thrown a thing at another thing. You know, like we get angry. We have maybe some aggressive tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
Is politics the ultimate answer, you know, like for adults who haven't dealt with something? You know, I don't want to.
Well,
I think it's subconscious for sure.
Okay.
And it just never ends up resolving anything. They're just kind of maybe they're just playing out or repeating out all the aggression that's ever been done to them in their own lives, you know.
But they can do it behind the cloak of legitimacy that is a government. That's right. That's what allows them to do it.
Right, because they don't cheer for organized crime.
No.
You know, I mean, people like The Sopranos, but that's...
It's a great TV series.
Yeah, that's fantasy, you know. Well, yeah. I mean, not if you live in New Jersey. It's exactly like that. But, you know...
Where's my gabagoo? No. Somebody's going to get that, trust me.
I get it.
Thank you.
And I'm offended.
You never had gabagoo?
Yeah, I've had it.
It's overrated. Anyways. It is.
Anyway.
I bet you could produce a gabagoo.
We'll leave that one in. That was good, Stephanie.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
We could do an extended edition. Oh, you see what I did there? Extended?
Yes, I do.
This is capricola ham.
It's totally overrated.
Yeah.
Well, with my gabagoo.
I wouldn't eat it alone, but you know.
I ate it alone.
No, I mean, I wouldn't eat it by itself. I'm sorry. I meant that. You're very lonely.
I meant that. I meant eating it alone, but it was me playing on words. Just as I said, an extended edition for the gabagoo.
Right. That was terrific.
Thank you. I'm just on fire today.
So.
Something's burning.
Man,
Something is burning.
We're way
my
off.
My loins.
Oh, my goodness. All Poor right. Brett. He's trying to make a point.
No, but we're walking back to the
tracks. I got
tracks.
A point to make.
We're walking back to the tracks together. We're going to get back on.
Okay.
So, you know, I think that's an important question here, but now I'm even more confused because, you know, I used to think, well, if you could just show people, like, you know, wrong for me, wrong for you, wrong for this group of people calling themselves government. But I think that this is meeting some kind of need. This whole political arena is meeting some kind of need for these people. So
maybe in a very costly way.
Well, that's what I think. And, yeah. You know, that's the real danger of, you know, this whole Ron Paul for presidency campaign. What if Ron Paul got elected? You know, so here's the ultimate death, I think, of these ideas for centuries to come, where people have to learn about liberty by having it imposed on them through the use of force. You know what I mean? So it's like what Ron Paul has done, even these debates with these people who are on the stage, if you listen and you listen to some of the things people like Mitt Romney were saying in 2008, he can't talk that way anymore. He can't say, I think we should double Gitmo. You know, Ron Paul has changed the dialogue in those debates, even though he's barely talking. Like, I really believe that. And he's brought a lot of new people to these ideas.
Well, look, he's the whole Tea Party thing, for sure.
Sure, which has been, you know, co-opted and corrupted
exactly.
At this point. But it did bring people in. It did get a new kind of language into, you know, the media's coverage of politics, I think, and even some of these political candidates are having to talk more his language. So this, if you consider the insanity of the political system and the political dialogue in this country, to accomplish what he's done educationally and then, you know, get elected president, it's kind of like, for my first trick, I'm going to, you know, walk across Niagara Falls on a tightrope, and for my second trick, I'm going to saw my feet off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, like, these ideas would just die with him, you know, as president. And I think one of the things that's interesting is there's already two sort of tests that I can think of that are going on in this country for what a Ron Paul presidency would look like. And I make this point because you can't insert little, you know, droppers, milliliters of sanity into a current of insanity and expect it to be any kind of meaningful change. We have what's going on in the state of New Jersey with the governor there, Chris Christie, who's tried to take on the NJEA, the teachers union. And
I'm not familiar with this.
The backlash has been tremendous. There's, you know, they send out the teachers union, supposedly they say it was a joke, but they sent out memos asking people to pray for him to die. You know, and he's a, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
You showed, I believe you created a video of this, didn't you?
I don't think so.
Oh, maybe you linked to it. You played audio from it, I want to say, on one of your previous podcasts.
I might have done that.
From video. I think that's what it was.
So we see, and this is, I mean, Christie is just saying that, you know, he's only really so far dealt with public sector unions. So imagine that compounded. Well, before we go, you know, back to Ron Paul, we also have what we've talked about. Even Stephanie, you and I have talked about it on Free Talk Live in the past. Was the situation in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Where the governor of that state, Scott Walker, I'm not a fan or a defender of him, but I think it made sense when he said that, you know, teachers shouldn't be able to negotiate for their future benefits. You know, they shouldn't be at the bargaining table talking about pensions that future taxpayers are going to have to pay. Like, politicians shouldn't be able to have the future productivity of people who can't even vote now as bargaining chips to get them reelected. So the
But that's what democracy is all about.
Exactly.
That's the whole basis of the entire system. They steal from the unborn.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it was so hypocritical for the teachers to say that this was an assault on children, you know? To ask these people to not be able to negotiate their pension plans, that they should be able to only negotiate for things that they could be answerable to now, like out of the existing tax base. Like, you can talk about pay because those taxpayers are paying into the system now,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and they're the people who are voting now.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't negotiate for stuff that's happening in the future. So the saddest thing was they actually got, you know, their own students to march in support of their financial, you know,
enslavement.
Destruction. Yeah, yeah. Of their future prosperity.
Well, it was like extra credit. It was some pretty shitty stuff going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, to get those kids out there. Well, and, you know, I the whole time I was just thinking, what's a pension? How do I get one of those?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think that's a good point. You know, that these people, that level of entitlement, and it's not, I don't think so much it's the individual teachers. I think they're kind of suckered into it.
It's the system that they, yeah. that's what they were, that's what they've been expecting since before they got into it, is this, hey, you just work this certain amount of years and then you're set.
So imagine trying to, just looking at what's going on in these two little states, just with teachers unions, and trying to apply that to every public sector union across the country.
When he starts ending departments and stuff too, I mean.
Yeah, what about the military?
Yeah.
Troops, I mean, it was obviously, yeah, we would want troops to be out of all these other countries.
But they'd basically be getting laid off, right?
So you're going to have 100 and whatever, you know, however many thousand people there are in other countries who've been trained to be pretty violent, come back to this country and be bored. So it would essentially be like this country being invaded. It would essentially be, it would look and feel like as if a foreign country invaded the United States. You know, no uniforms, maybe not walking around with guns, but I think that would be, in effect, you know, what would happen. And it would be, my point, I guess, is that the world is in 2012 is not ready enough for these ideas. And certainly, they will never be ready to have these ideas imposed on them.
Mm. So, yeah,
I think you're completely right about, at least about him not being able to make any meaningful change as a president. Because, yeah, I mean, he would get fought at every corner.
Yeah.
By all the people who would be laid off or whatever. And, you know, I really paused when you said that thing about the troops coming home. Because you're right, there's no structure to take care of them or give them the health care that they were promised or anything like that. And they all have, I would say almost all of them have some form of trauma that they're dealing with, psychological, physical, traumatic brain injury, all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah. And as you said, they've been trained to be really violent. And if the trauma doesn't come from, you know, just being in the military itself and the circumstances that they're in, I mean, it's from combat, it's from being hurt or seeing horrible things,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, what are they going to do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've never even heard anybody just bring that up like that, because I look at it. Yeah, they need to get out. They shouldn't be in other countries. They shouldn't have these bases in Japan. But yeah, what happens when they come home? You know,
well, yeah. No, I mean, it is
it's crazy. Yeah. It's just
somebody sent me a question on my show about Ron Paul bringing the troops home, and he said, well, if Ron Paul gets elected, I don't know if it would be a good thing if he brought all the troops home, because where would they work? Yeah. And I wasn't thinking of it like that, Brett.
Trained killers.
I thought of it. I was like, well, at least they wouldn't be being killed.
Yeah.
And
of
course it's better. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that's only in theory, right?
Yeah.
Because who knows what would happen?
Yeah.
And if they come back and there's no jobs, I mean,
But at the same time, you don't want to. I don't want it to sound like, oh well, yeah, that's all true. But I still don't support them being.
No,
I still don't support
not.
Those
no.
bases
yeah, yeah.
existing. So it's like,
yeah.
what's the answer? It's,
there's no
there's
good answer.
No
at this
good
point.
Answer.
There's a, we. The, we're in a trap.
No, yeah. it's, the yeah. government is the perfect paradoxical combination of a black hole and a dead end. You know, like with all of these things, there's like from here. There are no short-term solutions. And I really think, and I really, you know, I've really embraced what, you know, Stefan Molyneux says again and again about this is not a short-term project. Major philosophical human evolutions take a long, long time, and people need to resign themselves to that.
And I think you need, your target audience needs to be exactly who the target audience of this show is. I mean, the youth, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that the parenting, the treatment of children in school in other places is where the focus needs to be. I think school is particularly important because my only apprehension with the family versus school is that school, I think, is far less intrusive. Most parents are already relatively probably unhappy with how the education system is working.
Yeah.
And it was an easier way in. And, you know, as far as school sucks is concerned, kids already feel that way.
Yeah.
So I have put my focus there. Of course, that's also where I spent most of my career.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the things that I've realized about the family have been in the process of doing this show, through doing this show, through listening to Wes or Steph,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, reading Alice Miller.
Mm-hmm.
So... That's, you know, I'm already kind of on the path that I'm on. I think that, you know, Steph, Wes, they do a great job with what they do, and I certainly recommend their work
to learn more about what
goes on in childhood outside of school.
I have something that I think might get us back to where we were going with the original topic, which is, you know...
Ron Paul.
Right, Ron Paul, but not only him, but is it counterproductive to support him or for people to be so interested in him?
Right, and I think that the reason why I said it was counterproductive is because we're going to show people these ideas and then support a system, support a process that forces these ideas on them. That doesn't make any sense.
You're right.
Yeah, there are more reasons, too, I think, that we've already touched on that it's counterproductive. And one is the wasted time and energy, because there's inevitably, I mean, people have been banging their head against a wall for 200 years and then some, trying to change things through the political process.
Yeah.
And it hasn't worked. It never will work. It never has worked. Or even in very rare circumstances where maybe somebody got what they wanted and what they were working for within the system. I mean, it's so easy for the political people to just turn right around and reverse whatever they just did.
You know what I learned about the political system? I learned that this is what I was taught, that the objectives are to get what you want and to cause pain. Literally, this is the exact quote, cause pain to your opponents. And they define pain as, like, you know, that making look them looking bad in the press and other ways. And I learned that from, I went to a Campaign for Liberty conference. It was about 2 weeks after I became a voluntarist. I had already paid for it. And this is, you know, I was like excited to go. And then it's like, I was just like, oh God, I paid for this thing. And now I don't even, you know, I'm not even a minarchist anymore. I don't even care about the political system, but I still went. And they had like this class, like how to run for office. And this guy came up and spoke. He's like, I've done a million of these. He's talking about, he seemed like he knew what he was talking about. You know, he knew how to play the game, and he just broke it down. And he was just as blunt as could be.
No bones about it.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, wow, cause pain. It's just like, that's the exact line he used.
That makes me feel kind of sick.
Yeah.
But I had one of those moments too, Mandrick, when
that was the Ron Paul thing. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, they're in the same system.
Yeah.
They really are. And there's no meaningful difference. When you're in that system, you have to adjust to it in order to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say, I had one of those moments when a while back, I think it was during the 2008 campaign when I was still paying attention to this stuff.
Okay.
There, Sarah Palin or somebody had this map where she was targeting political opponents, and she literally had like crosshairs. Superimposed on a map of the U.S. or maybe it was even over faces, but I think it was just a map. And I looked at that and I was just like, this is such a violent thing. And then all these other instances came to mind of just all the words that they use, the fight, the struggle, the war, the battle, you know, the battleground, the horse race, the, you know, it's all of these violent metaphors, and it's so explicit. It's so under everyone's nose, but yet it's like the most invisible thing ever, because to most people, they do not associate it in any way with violence. But yet, as Brett really eloquently pointed out tonight, they're playing out these violent fantasies.
And the other question is, was it ever, people have this idea, this we've talked about this many times before, on my show at least, of this this golden age, right? For a lot of people who are older and more conservative, it's the 50s,
when Merca was the great place to be.
Yeah. And you know, then there was the
wasn't there something with the blacks not having, you know, go to different water fountains and stuff during that age?
Well, the women. You know,
If you're
smack the secretary on the ass.
That was the golden, you know, they were cooking for you.
Yeah.
Now I'm cooking for you. I'm not a woman.
The reason why I bring it up, though, is, you know, you mentioned the Sarah Palin with the targets, you know, of people. Yeah. So shortly after that, the left-wing media started to blame her in her rhetoric for the shooting that happened with Gabrielle Giffords, who was a Democratic congresswoman. And shortly after that, Barack Obama gave a speech where he called for a return to civility. Now, when was this civility in the political system? If you go back, I might be exaggerating a little, but not much that it's not so much that it's misleading. Mm-hmm. When people like John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were running against each other, they were circulating stuff that they like raped sheep. Like that,
oh
they
my
were.
God.
That,
there was like, horrible things.
That,
oh,
like
yeah.
I think it was either Reason Magazine. They did this really funny piece where they show actual language that was being used by the two campaigns in these elections.
Some political watchers are saying this could be the nastiest, most negative election season of all time.
This campaign season seems like candidates have taken dirty to a whole new level.
When pundits start shouting and politicians start calling each other's names, it can seem like a return to civility is not possible. Like the very idea is a relic of some bygone era.
John Adams is a blind, bald, crippled, toothless man who wants to start a war with France. While he's not busy importing mistresses from Europe, he's trying to marry one of his sons to a daughter of King George. Haven't we had enough monarchy in America?
I'm Thomas Jefferson, and I approve this message because John Adams is a hideous, hermaphroditical character with neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman.
If Thomas Jefferson wins, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes. Are you prepared to see your dwellings in flames, female chastity violated, children writhing on a pike?
I'm John Adams, and I approve this message because Jefferson is the son of a half-breed Indian squaw raised on hoe cakes, and Hamilton is a Creole bastard brat of a Scotch peddler.
I might have gone a little too far with raping sheep, but that's in the neighborhood. That's in the neighborhood, you know. It wasn't like, my opponent doesn't have sound positions on
And the sad thing is they might have actually been abusing slaves, but that wasn't like, that wasn't a thing that would appeal to people.
Having slaves is abuse.
Right, but you think about that. You have John Adams, somebody who I don't remember. I don't believe it wouldn't make sense for him to own slaves. He lived in Boston.
He was still a pretty horrible
Oh, sure. Sure. And then, you know, like that would seem like a pretty effective attack ad. Like Thomas Jefferson owns 200 people and has sex with one of them. Yeah. And she can't say no because he owns her.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? But that, you know, that probably never came up in that campaign because that was okay.
It's maddening. Crazy.
So there never was civility in politics. There never was politeness or respect or dignity in political dialogue.
Yeah, but
that's not what politics is.
They wore wigs, man. That's dignity. And they had nice accents.
It was more dignified than today, for sure.
Pomp and circumstance. Just,
you know, that's a really interesting example, and it just points out that that's the nature of the system. Even when people romanticize this time when there was a small government supposedly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the founding fathers and all that and all the constitutional stuff, and they still actually read the Constitution. It was the same old thing. It was all just the same violence played out in wigs.
Yeah. And that's that's another thing that takes us back to the main topic of the show, is that Ron Paul talks about these guys with such respect and reverence, as if they had this vision, and like if we hadn't strayed away from this amazing foresight that they had, everything would be fine. And if we could just return to that, everything would be fine. That's just another religion. I mean, you know, I think the most popular religion in the world today is the state, you know, and yeah. We have the monuments, we have the statues, we have the stories, just like any other religion.
Yeah.
And, I think that the closer you look at some
scripture.
Of these people, sure, yeah, yeah. The closer you
the
look,
priest.
The Sunday school
yeah.
of government school lasts
except
for 12 years.
Except it's every day.
Yeah. Exactly. I think if you look more closely at some of these people, you see that they did not have these benevolent intentions, and they just wanted to. They wanted to be the masters. Mm. They didn't want to have a master like yeah. you know the British Crown. They wanted to be the master. So that doesn't really resonate with me. It's a shame that 4 years ago that argument of returning to the Constitution was more powerful. Was as powerful as it was then. I kind of wish that, having been a history teacher, I could have seen through that at that point.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But the only time I would still bring up the Constitution is to expose the hypocrisy. Like, we're told, we're a nation of laws. Well, except for the people who make the laws, and except for the people who, the highest executive offices in this country.
Oh, yeah.
They live in anarchy, pretty much,
Yeah.
And not an anarchy that has at its center any kind of morals.
Yeah.
Just the complete kind of bomb throwing or, in this case, like missile launching anarchy. So.
Yes. Yeah, that's very well put. Now, you said something before, Brett, about that you think people are trying to meet some needs by participating in politics. And I agree with that, but like, can we brainstorm what do we think that's getting them? What are they trying to fulfill from that?
It's a good question, and I hate to try and, or I don't even like the way I sound when I psychologize, it's like psychologizing, all these people that I've never met and don't know, but I think there is a very clear pattern there.
Yeah, we can think of it, I like to think of it anyway, as just trying to understand where they're coming from, and empathize sure. with them. I don't want to diagnose them with anything, I just...
Right, from the people that I do know, I think that nobody wants to feel useless.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people want to feel like they're not good or not capable of good. But some people might have been through, so much trauma in childhood, in education, through their religious upbringing, that they just can't live their adult life in a way where they're really helpful or compassionate towards other people, like I have an uncle that I've talked about this stuff with a lot. He's very liberal. He has all these fantasies about all the things the government can do. He's happy to pay his taxes because it goes for this and this, and these things are important. But in his personal life, he's never lifted a finger to help another person. Mm-hmm. He's never reached out to anyone, even his own family, and said, do you need help? Are you okay? How are you doing? So liberalism, or that side of it anyway, seems to be about, to me, pretending that you're saving the world without lifting a finger,
Do you think some of that comes from the kind of rewards and punishments that people are raised with? Like, you get rewarded for seeming like you're a caring, compassionate person, or seeming like you're trying to be a leader or to help people?
I think that's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just trying to think, like what you said before about not wanting to try to psychologize people is a valid criticism. And so I'm just going to talk about, for me, like what I think was going on in myself when I was participating in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was a lot about fitting in.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, my need for acceptance was like really threatened by the notion of me working outside the system in any kind of way to achieve more liberty. And I've been able to, like, you know, deal with that and to have the confidence in my own abilities and not be so desperate to have other people accept me so that I'm okay with doing it now. But back then it was just like this desperate fear that people wouldn't take me seriously or wouldn't like me, mm-hmm. you know, which is kind of ironic because when you're in politics, you make a lot of enemies. Like you may make some friends, but you make a lot of enemies. It's very polarizing.
But you also insulate yourself too. Like even if you're just a participant in the political system as a voter, mm-hmm. you know, all your friends, if you're a Republican, all your friends might not be Republicans and you might argue with them. You might have some kind of empty turd throwing contest with them about whatever the issues are. You know, mm-hmm. I've watched those kinds of discussions most of my life.
Every barbecue you ever go to.
Yeah, they've never changed. You know, like the names change and the situation changes, but the tone of the argument is always the same and the productivity yep. of the argument is always the same. So even though those people, you know, they might have to deal with some conflicts when they go to their news sources, when they go to their media, they insulate themselves by, I'm conservative, so I read the Wall Street Journal and then I watch Fox News yes. and then I listen to conservative radio and I listen to people that make me feel like I'm right. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you're a politician, you surround yourself with people who are sycophantic and who are going to tell you that you're great and that you're doing the right thing and that your work is so
important.
And give
you money.
Yeah. So I think that both of those might be an example of what you're saying.
Yeah, of trying to fit in.
Or trying to find something that makes you feel that certain way.
Yeah, belonging to a group. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of it, too, is about identity. You know, like a lot of people want to have something that they can identify as or identify with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, it's still true to a certain extent. Like we will label ourselves voluntarist or libertarians or whatever. But, you know, a lot of people, I saw this a lot in college. Like, a lot of people want to say like, well, I'm a X. I'm a Democrat. I'm right. a liberal. I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican. I'm a young Republican. Or, you know, whatever it is. And that goes back to the fitting into a group as well. But, you know, it becomes a part of you. And, like, some people have such a hard time letting go of the political process because it turns into such a big part of who they are. You know, it's like it's linked to their – it's almost like their orientation or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that's a part of your identity, and if you give that up, then you're giving up a piece of yourself. That's how seriously some people take it.
And how much does the world lose in terms of creativity and productivity? There's a lot of people who sort of struggle with these political ideologies. Like I met this woman, or I know this woman, and she was talking about this. She's like, well, I'm a conservative. I'm definitely a conservative, but I'm kind of liberal on social issues.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
sounds
oh, so
to me,
like, oh, so you're, like you're a libertarian? No.
I'm a conservative.
I'm a conservative. I'm not a libertarian.
Like you know, because, she has to have a home base where she feels comfortable going, yeah.
So I mean, for most people, like, those are the two labels that would only be considered acceptable. But you're right, way beyond that, people still want to kind of fit into these groups. And there's a real conformity in this. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say, like, what do we lose? I was watching this video, Charlie Veach. I don't know if you guys know who that is. The Love Police.
Yeah.
And he's on England in a blowphone. What's a blowphone?
A bullhorn?
A bullhorn.
A blowphone.
Every time I see one from now on, I'm calling it a blowphone. It's a fine name for it. It's like you pick, when I said blowphone,
hey, I knew
you
what
pictured
you meant.
What I meant.
Yeah.
I picture something completely different, but go ahead.
Hello, blowphone.
Okay.
Ooh-wee.
Indeed.
$1.99 per minute. So Charlie Veach is on he's on his bullhorn in this crowd in England, and he's doing this kind of comical parody of the Occupy mm-hmm. protest, and he's telling the people that nothing is wrong,
everything is okay, right? That's
yeah,
his line.
That's the sign. And at one point, he said something like, "You are the only example, the only example of you that will ever exist mm-hmm. in the universe." You know, stop trying to fit in. You know, the way he said it, I thought was Very powerful.
Did he say you are a unique snowflake, just like everybody else?
No, because that would be silly.
It would be ironic.
You know?
But, yeah, that's a despair.com demotivator, actually.
I've seen it, yeah.
But so many people give up so much to fit in.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But people want to be accepted. I mean, we all have that need. I mean, that's why I moved to New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Well, part of it. I mean, if you think about evolution, like people ran around with groups of other people who looked like them and took care of each other in terms of food and stuff like, and shelter and their kids and everything. And that's really powerful. You know, like people want that and feel that they need it to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's perpetuated now because of the way that people are raised with all this nationalism, and they're just taught from a very early age that, like, hey, you belong to these groups, and it's really important to have this group identity and to stay within the group because they'll have your back. They'll take care of you. It's your religion or your country or whatever.
There's nothing wrong with a desire for support from other people or belonging even to a group. Mm-hmm. But when some coercive organization superimposes themselves on a group that they make and say, okay, because of this landmass, we're all one group, mm-hmm. and we're in the group too. So when you talk about us, say we and us and our, you know, don't say those guys.
Yeah, that's an amazing example and a very obvious one that I should have thought of how collectivism just starts. Yeah. It has this roots even in language.
It would be funny it would never be funny if pirates got on a cruise ship, but if the pirates, the first thing they did was says, okay, if you guys want to talk about us, you don't say the pirates, you just say we. Just say we.
Yeah,
just
it's,
say we.
It's so ridiculous when you...
I wonder if that's going to happen when Wes goes on that cruise. There's going to be some pirates that get on and say, you have to say we.
He'll straighten them out. He'll, you know.
He'll NVC them.
He'll NVC their asses.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
My need for yar is not being met.
No. Yeah, but no.
No, I like that.
Thank you. Thank you.
But, yeah, I mean, talking about needs, actually, seriously, like, there are other needs, I think, that politics meets for some people in a perverse kind of way, of course. And another one is to do something meaningful.
Yeah, exactly.
So many people just want purpose in their life to do something that means something, to create some mark that they'll have on the world.
Alan Greenspan was being interviewed once,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he was talking about his deliberate use of confusing language to people would try to ask him tough questions,
mm-hmm.
and then he would just say something that was so cockamamie that it would sound like he answered the question, but he would use words that everybody knows, but use them in a way that didn't make any sense.
Wow.
He would do this deliberately. And then
person, people would hear it and think,
he's bragging about
they
it.
Would be, they would be too embarrassed to say, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh my God.
So he says, the woman says, well, you know, you get these tough questions and, you know, don't you ever worry about somebody coming back and saying you didn't really answer that question or your answer not, you know, giving people what they want. He said, no, you see, these politicians, they don't care about my answer. They only care about being on TV asking me the question.
Wow.
They only care about people back in their district seeing them hold my feet to the fire. You know, that was the gist of it. I mean, he might have said it a little more simply than
that. Yeah.
But, you know,
that's surprising that he would admit that.
It was surprised.
After he probably retired.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Of course.
So that whole political process, that whole scene there is a big show.
But he basically opened up the playbook for you and showed you his secrets.
And this goes back to, like, the reverence and the respect and you know, just the worship that people have of the law.
Oh, well, that's exactly it. I mean, that's what I wanted to say about Ted Kennedy and stuff, and you brought up a great point about Alan Greenspan. It's like, people see this bullshit,
mm-hmm.
and they think, wow, that's so inspiring, like... They see all the praise that these people get, and they see just the sycophantic mm-hmm. worship, as you said, of these people. And they're like, that's what I want to do. If I could do something like that, my life would really be meaningful.
Yeah.
I could change the world. I could do something good. And in some cases, they actually believe that that is like the most honorable, meaningful thing that you could possibly do.
Why do you think so many people join the military?
Yeah.
Well, in the last, yeah, and that's what I got. You know, like people, you get in these kind of arguments and you put somebody maybe on the defensive a little bit too much, and they'll say things with the intention of hurting you, you mm-hmm. know, if you're presenting these ideas.
Yeah.
So in the last, you know, last discussion that I got into that was heated, the person I was talking to, who usually I don't really, hadn't had too many heated discussions with, said, you know, if you really want to do something, you'll run for office. But right now, you've never done anything. He said, you're a small person, and you've never helped anyone. So, no, I, whatever, you know,
yeah.
water, what do you say?
Water off your back.
Water off your back.
Off a duck's back.
Water under the bridge means no problem. Yeah. Water off a duck's back. So, you know, but you see that people look at those kind of figures as like, that's what it really means
yes.
to make a difference.
Yes.
Right?
How many laws did you create?
Well, that's the whole thing, too. People maybe wouldn't have such reverence for it's the law, you need to know the law, ignorance of the law is no excuse, if they saw what went into a law being made, you know?
Yeah.
And the language you use, completely foreign language.
Well, that's true,
it's
too.
It's just insane.
But people don't even realize this process. I mean, somebody writes, I have a terrible idea to make it look like I did something, right? So I wrote this law. And then, you know, they show it to other people, and they say, that's not... you know, that I don't like that. You know, that's not going to pass. But I'll tell you what, I'll vote for it if you put an earmark in it of $185,000 so I can build a beaver museum in my district. So when re-election
time
comes...
Who doesn't love the beavers?
Well, yeah. But when you get 20 of those earmarks into one of these bills,
yeah.
you know, now you have a bad law that all of these people are going to support.
Yep.
And it gets through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, all right, so I have a bad law. Who owes me a favor? And I'll give them an earmark, and then they'll vote for my law, and then they'll get their people, you know, their little clique. I'm sure there's cliques there.
Yeah.
There's got to be cliques. They'll get their clique in on this.
They call them caucuses, but
yeah.
they're cliques.
Yeah. and I mean, and that's the lawmaking process. You don't learn about that in civics class. But yeah. I think that just goes back to that sort of empty, unthinking respect for authority that people have, too. The law is the authority. So.
Oh, yeah. They could never be doing anything bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I learned about log rolling in government high school, but it was like really glossed over.
Sure.
You know, and log rolling is when they put the earmarks into the bills and stuff like where they piggyback one thing onto another.
Yeah.
Basically, right? And I mean, I probably wouldn't remember that today if I wasn't a libertarian, you know.
Right.
It was that unimportant. I know it is just so it just seems so backwards when you look at society. And all the people who think that politics is the only way that you can ever get respect, the only way that you can ever change anything, the only way that you can do something important or meaningful.
Yeah.
It's just not true.
Oh, those are the people who really never did anything important or meaningful in a good way. You know,
well,
they were never politicians. They were never presidents. They were never... congressman, and it doesn't mean that everything they ever did was bad, but the real steps to changing the world to real progress, you know,
mm-hmm.
and real sort of, you know, moral and philosophical evolution, those people were never power seekers because that's not why you seek power. That has nothing to do with wanting power. And I think that's so bizarre that people would think that that's the only way you can really change things in a good way because those people have never changed anything in a good way.
I think they believe that because that's what they've been told their whole life.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you were a history teacher, Brett, right, you probably saw this.
Mm-hmm.
It's like history is all about the dead white guys who were in power, you know.
But the narrative, the way the narrative is put together is amazing because it's like it's genius. In how you start and stop stories in just the right place
yeah.
to make it look like a problem started suddenly and shockingly and then was solved by the force of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that same thing over and over and over, but there's never any continuity. There's never any causality. You don't really see the 100 years of events that might have led up to World War II.
Yeah,
you get Pearl Harbor.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, you don't see the effects. You know what happened in Germany after World War One.
No, and you don't see what happened after World War II either. You don't. There's no follow up on, you know, to save the world from this evil dictator in Central Europe who had killed millions of people. You know, the United States and Great Britain empowered and funded this evil dictator in Eastern Europe who had killed millions of people. And then that led to, you know, all this whole next series of wars. And when hundreds of millions of people were sucked into the Soviet gulags after the end of the World War II, you know, Churchill and Truman, they turned their backs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there was no more. This was not, you know, a fight for freedom or justice or any American way. And no one would ever know that because the story doesn't go there. You know, chapter 23 is World War II. Chapter 24 is television and hula hoops or whatever's next. Maybe.
It's so refreshing to know that the internet's out there, and if you really want to find the true story, you can.
Yeah.
You just have to want to look. You just have to want to question what you're being taught.
And it's great, too, that the bad stories are still there, because it's a good way to learn the information literacy and not to be, you know, not to offend anybody, but it's also a good way to see how ridiculous what passed for common knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
Once. It actually is.
Yeah.
That many of us bought.
Yeah.
I used to love FDR.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is even something that in my career.
You mean Franklin Delano Roosevelt, not Freedom in Radio, right?
Oh, yeah. I do love the more modern FDR.
Even in my teaching career, yeah, I was dealing with those people in that way.
Yeah.
You know, that, and I was called on it, you know, by students who were from the inner city. And they knew these stories were bullshit. They knew the government wasn't there to help them. They were on, you know...
They knew from personal experience.
They were on welfare. They lived in housing projects, maybe SSI. Some of them were in state custody. They were having, you know, these drugs and their stay at this boarding school subsidized. They were dealing with bureaucrats who were acting as guardians. Very messy. But, you know, they saw through my pretty... When I first started, my mainstream version of history, they said that's... Then what happened, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Why does government look like this to me? Mm. So.
You guys want to wrap this up?
Yeah. So I think just.
So Ron Paul 2012. Okay.
There's a money bomb coming up, guys. Oh, by the way, I have to just mention this. Money bomb? Really?
Yeah.
They're going to call it a bomb?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when they did this in 2008, picking Guy Fawkes Day, the Guy Fawkes mask.
Really?
The end the Fed. These are not how any of these larger problems are ever going to get solved. Like, would it be nice if, like, would it be better if Ron Paul was president than Barack Obama? Well, no, it wouldn't matter, and it might be too much too fast. You know, would it be good if we didn't have a Federal Reserve? Sure, but that's not. But come on.
But you're right. It uses the same violent language that all politics always uses.
Exactly. I really hope people can get over the idea of politics. And I think if you're already supporting Ron Paul, you know the government can't solve your problems. So I think you're a step ahead of the Occupy movement. But I would really encourage people to think about this carefully before they direct any more effort or energy or emotion into it. Because all three of us did that 3 years ago. And, you know, we've told you our story. Closing thoughts?
Well, that's what I care about, what you just said, Brett, about people's energy and time and emotional investment that they may or may not be making in politics, or maybe they're confused about whether to make it. I just want people to have joy in their lives and happiness, and I think that it's pretty hard to do that when you're entrenched in this violent system and following it like a gladiator sport.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to add.
That's what I expected.
Oh, you want me to... I don't know. I mean, people should just spend that time that they could have spent with the Ron Paul campaign, either both coming to a better understanding of the ideas of liberty and also working to improve yourself as a person.
Mm.
You know, getting more in touch with who you are, you know, what you enjoy in life, what needs you have, and not wasting your time with the whole idea of politics. I don't know. I mean,
no, I think that's really important too, because, you know, this is more than just arguments for morality and efficiency. This is in many ways a personal mental health issue.
Yeah, do things that you can will actually have an impact on your life. I mean, you're never going to have an impact politically, but you know, you can help become a better person and have a positive impact on the people around you. I mean,
right. Perfect. I knew you had something.
Yeah.
Wonderful left. And it's, you know, like when you decide that you want to, that something is wrong with the world and you want to do something, the saddest and most pathetic thing is to go and, you know, hold signs and say, this is what the government needs to do, or I'm going to vote for Barack Obama. And I think it's so strange to go to the place where you have the least amount of control and the least amount of influence and say, I'm going to direct all my energy there, when all of that energy could be so magnified and so much more potent if it was directed towards your personal life. And what I've learned from my own personal experience is the more time that I spend focused on these political things and, you know, watching the mainstream media and running these issues over and over again in my head, that costs me personal freedom. You know what I mean? Not just in time, but in my stress level.
Yep.
And I think that that can lead to thoughts and things that are unhealthy. So
you got it, Brett.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge for me. I think it's a challenge for everybody, but to try and move more of that energy towards the personal.
Yeah, words to think about.
Thanks for having me on, Brett.
Oh, this was long overdue.
Yeah, Brett, thank you for getting together. I really enjoyed our little late night after hours discussion.
See, none of it needs to be edited out. You never put what time it is because you never know what time they're listening to it.
It's true.
You're such a goddamn
timeless
rookie.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ.